You are listening to 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis, and this is Create Here. Produced by artists and curators from Big Car Collaborative, Create Here is your place to listen to conversations with people making intriguing, innovative, and impactful things happen on the cultural front in Indianapolis, Indiana, and beyond. Find out more and access additional episodes at WQRT.org.
Hi, this is Mary Goodwin from Aurora Photo Center, and we are here for Create Here at WQRT at Big Car Tube Factory. Thank you to Big Car Tube Factory for their sponsorship of this interview and for hosting our 2023 project resident, Ian Lewandowski, who is our guest today. Welcome, Ian.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So you are living in Brooklyn now, but you were born in Indiana, in Crown Point.
Correct.
I'm just going to read a little bit about your background. Sure. Your first solo exhibition, Community Board, was exhibited at the Java Project in Brooklyn in 2019. Another body of work, The Ice Palace Is Gone, is a body of color photographs that was made from 2018 to 19, and it was published as your first monograph by Magic Hour Press in 2021. My Man Mitch, a body of photographs and appropriated photo material native to Indiana, made from 2014 to 17, was published by Cult Books in 2022. So you teach at you teach undergrad photography courses at the New School and at SUNY FIT in New York, as well as continuing education courses at Gowanus Darkrooms in Brooklyn. And you also manage and print photo work for another artist, Kenny Gardner. You live in South Brooklyn with your husband, Anthony, and your dog, Seneca.
Yes. I have to shout her out in there, too.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Well, welcome. For these interviews, I love to start with a simple question, and that is, you know, how did you get into art making in general? Was there somebody in your family, something about growing up in Crown Point that led you to art and specifically to photography?
Yeah, sure. There were two artists in my family. My father, David, and his mom, Jerry, so my grandma, she was a painter. She painted, I remember, in the basement of their house, the house that my dad grew up in, actually, too. And she was painting all the time, and it was sort of like, that was what she seemed to be really passionate about and really good at. I mean, she, in her, actually before I was born, she had retired by the time I was born, but she was a draftsperson for an architect. So she was a very visually kind of minded person and drew all the time and painted all the time. And I think it was more sort of like what you could call like she would sell her stuff at like kind of craft fairs and things like that. But it was always really enthralling to me. And I now like own a lot of her work. And my dad was also an artist, made a lot of kind of paintings, sculptures when he was in high school. And then he went to college initially for like traditional cartooning, traditional animation.
Oh, so cool.
And he was for the rest of his life was a very like really amazing artist. I was always so impressed by what he did, but I noticed that they both like treated it as this other thing that was unrelated to their real job or their kind of it was like a secret sort of and so that was sort of the context. As a young kid, like I drew all the time. And so my grandma and my dad were so kind of enthusiastic about that and very supportive of that. But it was always under this banner of like, okay, like have fun with that, but like got to learn to like, you know, figure something else out. And so the idea of like a career as an artist was really foreign to me. It was really like, I had no real context for that until I was like kind of partway through art school, really.
Wow. You felt that even when you were in art school, that it wasn't sort of like job number one.
Right. Well, I knew that's what I wanted. And I was sort of like, well, I think I didn't actually have this vocabulary at the time, but looking back now, I think that I just knew that I sort of strove for like a world in which that could be my job, or that could be. So I was trying to just, I don't know, manifest it or something. To go back to your question. So I drew all the time when I was younger, and I actually got a scholarship out of high school, very small scholarship, to a local like liberal arts college that had an art program.
Oh, which one was it?
It was St. Joseph's College.
Okay. Yeah.
In Rensselaer, Indiana. And I got this small scholarship, and I actually turned it down because I was like, no, I'm studying something else, because like, that's not, you know.
Oh, I hope that's the last time you did that.
So I think like, it was like, I look back now, and it's so funny because I think the scholarship was for like $1,000 or something. It was like for.
That's what it represents, you know,
yeah.
The support.
It was, yeah, it was. And it was like this real honor. I remember my parents like were so proud of that, like that I had gotten this. So it was like, I got that scholarship out of high school, partly because I had an art teacher who, he had been the art teacher at my high school, like since the '70s. And then this was around the time I went to high school, kind of during the, there was this long period where there, you know, music programs and art programs were being kind of like funneled out of public, high schools, and, or, you know, elementary schools too. And at least in Indiana, mm-hmm. And my teacher had, been in like a car accident. He had been hit by a car and got this big settlement. This was like in the '90s, and he, was able to just live off of that settlement. And so he told the school, the high school, like, I'll just keep doing this, this program, and you don't have to pay me. So that was the only reason I had like anyone even advocating for, having any kind of like artistic life, when I was like a teenager, like adolescent. So, and like, I still didn't go immediately. I didn't right away go to art school, but that really stuck with me, that someone cared that much, you know.
That's a wonderful beginning. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it took you to Bloomington, where you studied photography.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I initially studied linguistics in college. The only other thing I was really like good at when I was younger was like language, or like English. And also like I was able to like memorize. I took French like all through school, and I was like pretty good at it. I excelled in that. And so I was like, language arts was kind of like another path, potentially.
So many talents. Oh my goodness.
But I was like, it became very clear once I arrived at IU that it just wasn't, I found that I was like more committed to my like art classes I was taking than my major classes, than my linguistics classes. So I was only a linguistics major for like one semester. And then I switched into the art program.
Yeah,
and I sort of did that. Sorry to, I'm just thinking now, remembering this. I sort of did that like, looking back now, I'm like, was that a strategic move? Because I think I was like, yeah, mom and dad, like, I'm all good. Like, I'll have a job, I swear. And then once I got there, I was like, never mind, I want to do this.
So, you decided to follow the dream.
Yeah. Which I think, like, I noticed a lot of students, I mean, you know, I teach now, and I see a lot of students start out in a program, and then they're like, actually, maybe something else. And I'm like, listen to that urge, because it's probably real. It's probably a true thing. So
yeah, that's the teacher in you talking. So speaking of teachers, so down at Bloomington, you studied with Jeffrey Wollen.
I did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was my teacher for like one of my very first photo classes. And I think the first, I don't remember his name, but my very first like photo teacher was a grad student actually, mm-hmm. and at IU. And I can't remember his name, but then I had Jeff, I never actually had a class with him, but James Nakagawa was there when I was there. So they were sort of, and that was really, I was like trying to impress them, I think, because I was sort of on the path to like try out for the BFA. You had to sort of opt into the program with like a portfolio review. And So I was on that path for like a year or so, kind of building this portfolio, taking classes and stuff. And then I, in that time, I had also applied to Pratt Institute in Brooklyn, which I was doing sort of on the urging of like a friend of mine. And it felt like so impossible. I was like, A, my parents are never going to let me do that. B, like, it's like I would have to, you know, uproot everything and like move and all this stuff. And so I ended up getting in there before the portfolio review happened at IU. So I ended up going to Pratt, and it was like probably the worst like financial decision I ever made in my life. But that was how I came to New York. And that was in, I started at Pratt in 2011.
So during your undergrad days, what was your subject matter? You know, like, so for your residency, you're here photographing queer Midwesterners, queer mm-hmm. Hoosiers. And I just wondered, did that as a subject matter for your work, for your portraiture, did that start in undergrad, or was that something that came about later?
I always, since the time I first, even when I drew, I always drew people. I was always more interested in people as a subject than anything else. And so when I took photos, it was the same. When I was an undergrad, when I was at IU, I was making a lot of portraits, also self-portraits. I was setting up, you know, an SLR 35 millimeter camera with like a self timer to take self portraits with. Once I moved to New York, I found that I had, and this is something I've thought about a lot recently, with some of, you know, the work I'm making for the residency and otherwise, I always had like 35 millimeter camera on me when I moved to New York. And it was this way of getting to know people. It was like a way of sort of socializing. Mm-hmm. And I was so petrified of people. I was so like, the only people I would photograph were very close to me and were sort of friends that I could had some kind of coded language with, of like, it's okay to photograph and it's okay to and so the camera was like this, in a way, like this shield, or this, what's it called? Like a, it was like an aid, like a social lubricant or something. And so it felt like the camera, and I didn't, at the time, I didn't really know that. I didn't exactly think of it that way. But when I look back now, I'm like, the camera's always been this thing that, for better or worse, I've hidden behind in some way. Huh. And I have similar feelings to that now with the camera I use, but it's a little different because my camera is so not, discreet. It's very, so at the time it was a little more like casual photos,
but now you work with a large format view camera, which is, there's no hiding that.
Right. No. Yeah. There's no, it's very, that's there.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So, when you got to New York, you mm-hmm. were just finishing up your first major series, the one that kind of got you on the board of, for being a national level artist, and that is My Man Mitch. You were working on finishing that up. Can you tell us a little bit about My Man Mitch as like a bridge between your Indiana life and your new life in New York?
So I started working on Mitch actually at the basically right after I graduated from Pratt, which was 2014. And so when I graduated from Pratt, I was my thesis from Pratt, my undergrad thesis was portraits made on a 4x5 camera, smaller view camera. And it was sort of a continuation of that 35 millimeter stuff, but it was sort of this thing of like, okay, I'm going to try to take these same pictures of people just on this bigger camera and like, you know, take the hour it takes to take the picture. And they were shot all in different places around Brooklyn and otherwise in New York. And so I had finished that work, and then I think when I graduated, I had no prospect for grad school. I was sort of just ready to like, okay, I'm gonna like enter the field and like try to make money, try to pay off some of this student debt. And I was still making portraits. I was still making portraits with a 4x5 camera. And at that time, right around that time, I'm the youngest in my family. So my brother and my sister both had like started having children around that time, and both live in Indiana. And so I was tr- making these like trips home from New York to Indiana and back. And I knew after I graduated that I wanted to make something about Indiana. I wanted to have some opportunity to go back, take pictures there, use, I had all these like yearbooks that were, belonged to my parents. My parents and most of my family all went to this one high school in Griffith, Indiana. And I had all of their, I ended up being sort of the family like archivist who just like held all of that stuff. And those were some of my first like really marked experiences with photography. Like I felt so drawn to the images in those books and just like how they were sort of like these like, you know, almost like a zine or something, like a, like this handmade book that was then like Xeroxed together. And I was so like, it just made me really curious about, I think from a young age, that was like maybe my route or something for photography. And so I was sort of like taking my own pictures and then scanning parts of these yearbooks and making like digital negatives of them and printing them and juxtaposing the two together. And that was really the only opportunity I had to go back was when my nieces and nephews were born. And so I had made like three or four trips and taken all these photos, and that over, I think it was over, 2014 to 17. So it was like 3.5 years. I had amassed this like huge, you know, group of images, and I was sort of like not quite clear on like, you know, I wasn't even really conceiving of it as like one body of work. I think that that's what it ended up being. But as I was making it, I was just trying to like work my way out of this thing. And I was also like, in a lot of ways, like breaking away from my family a lot in these more like political ways and sort of feeling a lot of isolation from my family during that time. And so the taking the photos and making that work was really a way to digest all of that too. And doing it in the place where I was born and sort of where I had felt isolated for most of my life, you know. And the yearbook thing, some people ask like, you know, why a yearbook? Like, why is that sort of the place you go to for like an image, like a past image or an appropriated image of this place? And I think the yearbook's interesting to me because like, it's made by young people. I think that's really important. It's like a book of photography that's made by young people, which doesn't happen very often. And B, it's like, that is like when I was in high school, I was in like the yearbook club, and it was really that was maybe like the only outlet for photography in my high school. So I was just thinking about like, this is potentially where like people like me were, or what people like me were doing, like a young person interested in photography. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, the yearbook as a form is definitely like really present in the architecture of My Man Mitch. Yeah. There's the end papers for My Man Mitch are really distinctive. And I feel like right there, when you open up the book, is a major part of the story of this art object, My Man Mitch, as a book. You know, this it's it's a montage, or it's a collage rather, of several images from either one or maybe multiple NASCAR races.
Yes.
So can you tell us a little bit about that NASCAR imagery and how it fits into the larger picture of My Man Mitch?
Sure. So among the, it's really funny because like when, like all the like photo material, I remember growing up, like all the, like the yearbooks and all the kind of like photo albums and like loose, you know, envelopes of drugstore photos were all stored in the same place in my mom's house. And among those were these several envelopes of photos that my uncle took at the Brickyard 400, which usually happened. It's in Speedway, Indiana, in Indianapolis. And in specifically like 1992 through 6. And I was there at those races. I was there at least for the latter, like 94 through 6, I think. Family's a NASCAR family. My uncle took those photos. And they're very kind of hypnotizing because they're so like repetitive. Like they're like kind of the same photo taken over and over of like each car going by. And it felt almost as you look at them, like if, as I was kind of like finding these and using them in the work, it was sort of, it felt like this interesting, like almost like endurance piece or something. And photo specific, right? Because it's like this big event. A lot of people have disposable cameras on them. Mm-hmm. And NASCAR, it was like, I, you know, as a kid, I hated it so much. I hated being like dragged along. my brother and my grandpa and my dad like loved it. So, but it was this like, cause it's like, it just feels like this like cacophony. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that weirdly, like in a roundabout way, like spoke really well to that work because it was like this cacophony of images that felt, almost like threatening to me as a young person, as a gay person, not just like the NASCAR photos, but also the yearbook photos. A lot of the appropriated images from the yearbook are these like boys like horsing around and like kind of being aggressive with each other and things like that. And it felt sort of like
definitely depictions that of masculinity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was something that, you know, from a young age was sort of lost on me. Like I felt like that felt like danger to me from mm-hmm. a young age. And being kind of, you know, visibly gay, like from a young age. And so that felt like those NASCAR pictures felt like this perfect little like bookends for this work. There was something else I was going to say about there's also this interesting, maybe this is like a roundabout thing, but like with NASCAR, it's like the whole sport and the whole kind of, it's all sponsorship. It's all brands like covering the cars
and the jackets. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all and about like, the logos.
It's,
yeah.
It's like it's like many sports, you know, it's something, it exists because of sponsorships. Mm-hmm. And, that felt like this interesting thing about like branding, and sort of like the brand of masculinity or the brand of,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And really, you know, in a roundabout, in like a more, umbrella way with the book, it felt like this, like even the title, My Man Mitch, was Mitch Daniels's campaign slogan.
Yeah.
When I was like an adolescent, when he was running for governor, mm-hmm. Even that phrase and that sort of idea of like a man's like dependability, mm-hmm. and sort of that, another, you know, another kind of thing that felt really like lost on me from a young age, and feeling like it was, it had this potential, that phrase had a potential to also be this space for like queerness or something, mm-hmm. like being almost like this like fantasy, but also like, yeah. So it's kind of complicated. It's like I wanted those two things to exist at the same time, like this space for like, a queer like existence or gay existence, but then also acknowledging kind of all the like the foundation that it was born on top of, if that makes sense.
It does. It's a beautiful book, and we keep talking about it as a book, but it wasn't actually your first book. Your,
right.
Your first book was actually the next body of work that you made. You didn't know it at the time, but it was bound to be called The Ice Palace Is Gone.
Yeah.
That's the title of the eventual book that was your first monograph.
Right.
So how did you get started? How did you transition from making the My Man Mitch work into making the work that would eventually become The Ice Palace Is Gone?
Yeah. It probably sounds confusing, but it's the, just to clarify, the Mitch work came first just chronologically, but then the book of Mitch came second.
Exactly.
After the,
yes.
Yeah. So it's kind of on paper confusing, but I like to, say to like, when I was finishing up Mitch and people were asking about it, I would try to say, well, it's sort of like a prequel. That's the right word, right? Prequel.
That's right.
Uh-huh. To the Ice Palace work. So the Ice Palace Is Gone. What I found at the end of, I had taken this picture in 2017 that felt like When I took it, I was like, that's the last one. That has to be the last one for Mitch. And the work just was done, you know, in my brain, it was finished. And finally I could like put these ideas together and things started to kind of click in that way. And then after that, I kind of treat every picture I took after that as the Ice Palace work. And I felt like there was this moment of like this door had opened, and like that last picture was me like shutting the door of Mitch and entering this new universe of the Ice Palace.
For those who aren't familiar with the work, how would you describe it?
The Ice Palace work. It's mostly portraits. It's portraits made on a large format camera, mostly 8x10. They're all in color. A lot of the Mitch book is black and white, or if not black and white, has a kind of pretty subtle minimal color palette. And so I was sort of just on a technical level in this place of like, I want to make, you know, it all in color. I want to kind of really stretch that part of it. And what it ended up being, I was taking kind of like picture after picture of all of people, and they were all, not all, but maybe like 90-95% indoors. They were all in like an interior. And most of the time that interior was just that person's home, that person, the place where that person lived. And so there was this sense that we, you know, we were in private taking these pictures together. I was like, most of the time just me and that person, or if there's more than one person. And it became this sort of like, as I would take the pictures and then look at them together, you know, they ended up being around like 200 or so pictures that I, like final images that I made in those 2 years. And I remember feeling like the Ice Palace felt like it was the environment where they were. It was like this kind of mythic environment where they like cohabitated or something.
I wondered about that, the genesis of the title.
Yeah, so the Ice Palace, the title comes from, there's a club bar on Fire Island in New York, which is sort of like a gay resort island, and it's called the Ice Palace. And I was really drawn to that name. Well, for one, so shortly after, I started making the work shortly after Pulse happened in Orlando, and I was thinking a lot, and then shortly after Orlando happened, the Ice Palace, this bar on Fire Island, part of it had burned down. And I think it was this moment where people immediately assumed it was like a malicious act, or it was sort of like a hate crime. And then it later came to find that it was kind of mysterious how this fire happened. It was like maybe insurance, like kind of related thing. It was like shrouded in this mystery. And I was thinking about how that was the immediate, like we live in a world where that's the immediate assumption, right? Like that's where like an accident happens, and the, because of what the essence of what it is, the immediate thought is like, well, it was done in malice of some kind. And I was thinking about that idea of like safety, and how I had made all these photographs indoors with people in their own homes. And there's a sense of safety there. Right. And the, that kind of imagery of it, of this bar being called the Ice Palace, I was really, really interested in that as an image of like this, grand structure that's like melting. And I felt like there was this, and this was around the time I was making the work, around the time of World Pride. World Pride was the like 50th anniversary of the Stonewall uprising, or it was on the occasion of that. And I was noticing like how, you know, every year, every few years, the terms of kind of a gay or a queer discourse get revised like constantly, like all the time, and always have to be kind of like torn down and then rebuilt and then torn down and then rebuilt.
Ah, that's your linguistic training.
So there was this like, so it felt like there was this moment where that clicked of like, it's like a castle made out of ice. Like it has to be torn back. But there was this thing of like, it's like, maybe it's okay that it has to get torn down and revised again. You know, that's how time and history like happens, right? So
that's right.
There was this sense that there had to be some kind of silver lining to, or not silver lining, but there had to be some kind of like hope out of these, like
some good that came out of it.
Yeah. Or like out of these sort of acts that could be malicious, or could be like, there has to be some way to like grow out of that. Right. And the work was mostly portraits. There are these, pictures kind of sprinkled throughout that are including the cover of the book, which are these like specifically like flat, planes of information. So, most of the time they're sort of like a bulletin board or so that the title of that first show I had in 2019 was Community Board, and it was sort of named after these photos, Community Board. And I was thinking of them as these sort of like staged, like, fictitious kind of, like a bulletin board where you would put up some kind of event or a, news, in like a queer space, a queer community. And that word was coming up like so much when I was making the work, like everyone's idea of it was like, oh, it's so amazing that you're making this, like, you're picturing this like queer community. And I felt a little bit hesitant about, you know, branding the work in that way, because I was sort of like, well, maybe, but it's all kind of like just through, like, a lot of these people don't necessarily even like know each other, you know. It's not as though, it felt like more abstract and more kind of expansive than that. And so these flat planes that I was making these fake like community boards on, some of them are actually real. I shouldn't say fake. Some of them are staged, some of them are actually like in situ, like in real places. But I felt that like by putting them in this book, that they were sort of like, and among all these portraits of people, that they were sort of like these little guideposts that could be like the directory or the navigation for the Ice Palace, for this like kind of how do you, like a nebulous like place. Mm-hmm. And so that place felt like it was like symbolic for things like safety for queer people, you know, this like sort of like, but that's what it felt like it represented,
which was very much on your mind at that time.
Yeah, exactly. So I think like I feel like that's a good way to describe like how I work. You know, I tend to like have like issues or questions or sort of like qualms, and the only way I find that works to like filter through them in my life is by taking pictures, and so oftentimes portraits. And so the portrait feels like it's almost more like the medium, you know, it's like the filter through which I like put all these ideas or thoughts, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. You know, it does seem as if there was a stylistic change, but mm-hmm. between the portraiture that you see in My Man Mitch and the Ice Palace work. Yeah. So the Ice Palace work feels like, yes, it's still, there's still portraits, there's still, you know, quote unquote, about the people in the pictures, but there is this increased presence of the idea of photography in the portraiture mm-hmm. in the Ice Palace, you know, like everything from, you know, the inclusion of the edges of the negatives around mm-hmm. the pictures. And then in some of the images you see stands, you know, lighting stands, and you see the edges of backgrounds. And in a couple of the portraits, the subjects are actually holding shutter release trip cords, you know, the bulb. Yeah. So it looks like they may be auto taking the picture themselves, but probably not. I mean, like, so there's this really strong presence of the idea of photography in these images that was more transparent in the My Man Mitch work. So how did that happen? What was that evolution all about?
I think like when I was making, so Mitch, it was like I said, it was the first thing I made after finishing undergrad, this very traditional photo program in which I felt very supported as a photographer, but also kind of stunted a little bit, because I felt like I had just spent like that, you know, 3 years, it was 2 years at IU and then 3 at Pratt, 3 years kind of in this almost like conservatory for photography. And I felt like I definitely was holding on to a lot of these, like, I have to like prove myself as a good user of this camera and a good kind of like, so as I was making the Mitch work, I can see, like, even now when I look at that work, I can see all these decisions that I was making out of, almost feeling like I had to like be self-disciplined and had to be sort of, following the rules. And, which is funny because like really what the book ended up being was I didn't go into, you know, I was going to sort of be with my family and revisit these like things from my past and the work kind of came out of that. It wasn't as though I went in and was like, I'm going to make this project. And so when I had finished that body of work, I think I felt a little more confident in like making the second thing. Mm-hmm. So when I made the Ice Palace work, I was thinking a lot about this medium that I had, you know, by then spent almost 10 years doing and thinking about constantly and thinking, you know, how the kind of sausage is made, you know, like how, and so showing the bulb, you know, showing that cord and showing the edges of the light stand. Even like, I think there's this, what I find, what, you know, for better or worse, I end up talking back to other photographers a lot in my work. I think that I really like that idea of like a dialogue among photographs, whether, you know, if it's a picture in my book and then it's a picture that I see online, or like, I like that idea of these things can be in dialogue kind of almost psychically or something. And so making this reference to like almost like reminding the audience or reminding even myself, you know, like this is a photograph. This is like a, this whole thing is like set up and yeah. So that it's feels important just because I think I'm more interested in like the setup than I am in like the illusion of there not being a setup. Does that make sense? Like, that's just my take on it. But like, 'cause I think a lot of the conventions that come up in photography or in portraiture are about like naturalism and kind of something being like an illusion. And I'm more interested in just the process of making the photograph. Yeah.
You know, I see references of photography also in a later body of work, Light Your Name from 2021.
Yeah.
This seems to, if you could tell us a little about that project, it seems like it was for a publication. Is that right?
Yes. So Light Your Name, it was a photo essay that it took me about a year to make. It's actually like, I consider it sort of couched inside of this larger body of work called Night Music, which I am now sort of thinking about publishing, showing to publishers. That's kind of like the next, hopefully, thing on the agenda. But so Light Your Name was sort of coming out of that work. It was, I was asked by a friend of mine to build a photo essay for a publication. The publication is called Public Journal. It's a Canadian art magazine. It's a Canadian sort of like literary journal. And I was asked by my friend who was the editor of that specific issue to sort of build a photo essay out of this one photograph I had made. The photograph was of my friend holding this poster for a gay discotheque that he had belonged to in the 80s. And the poster was sort of advertising like one of their events, like a party of theirs. And so I was very honored to continue to build something out of that picture. And I felt like it was, being asked to do that felt very affirming because it felt like someone could see the gears turning already and could see that I was interested in that thing. So, what I did was the club was called The Saint. The Saint was sort of an offshoot of the St. Mark's Baths, which was a bathhouse owned by this guy, Bruce Mailman, in the East Village in New York. And this is in the 80s. And so The Saint was sort of like meant as this like second, almost like satellite organization that was could serve the same clients, you know, this like kind of burgeoning community of gay men in New York. And so it was a specifically discotheque that was playing music from like 10 years prior, from the 70s. And it was very highly contested even among gay people, because it was you had to pay membership. And that was at that time, you know, that was, that decision was it's sort of one aspect of that decision was basically to circumvent the police, to circumvent having to hire another source of security. A lot of gay bars at the time were sort of defended for by the mafia, by organized crime. Mm-hmm. So in those days, you know, you like it wasn't totally out of the question for cops to still raid gay bars. Oh. And so the mafia was this way to like ward that off. Mm-hmm. And so having it be like a private institution was a way around that, basically. So speaking of, like we were saying with the utopia thing, with the paradise thing, I was really interested in this place because that was really the goal. The goal was to make this sort of like gay utopic space where it was out of time. It was actually anachronistic because the music was from 10 years before. Mm-hmm. And cops could not get in. Mafia could not get in. The straight people could not get in. Oftentimes what that ended up meaning is that only white gay men could get in. Oh. Like it was a very kind of, that's another reason it was so contested, was it was a very classist kind of thing. And so I was interested in sort of the issues that come up when you try to build this perfect thing, right? Like you end up excluding a lot of people, right? And so I made this essay sort of with these two men who were both members of the Saint, who had had memberships and had survived, had a lot of people who a lot of the clientele died of AIDS. And so there's a few kind of surviving members of this place who really are like trying to spread the gospel of it, because it was really kind of underground. And it wasn't quite like, you know, Studio 54 or something. It was really not photographed. And so I wanted to make these pictures about this place. And I even was a little skeptical, you know, like this wasn't anything I ever experienced. I'm too young to have experienced it. And so I would bring those concerns to these two men that I was working with that were just friends of mine that happened to be members in the 80s. And they were like, no, we like, no one cares about this place. We want it to be sort of documented in some way. And it was funny because I wasn't really documenting it. I was more kind of reimagining or constructing something that could speak to it. So that body, it's about 20 images. And the way it was published in public was, it's sort of like a side by side of an interview with Gil, who's one of the two men, and why am I forgetting his name? Right, Tim, who's the other member. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because they have they're such different people, and I photographed both of them too for this work, and they're so different, but it was so interesting to me that they had, and they claim to have never met each other, but I don't totally believe that. But they but they were in the same room, you know, every weekend for years at this club. And so I was really interested in that. I was interested in like how they had such different tape accounts, but they remembered like key events in the same way. And so there's like moments of the interview that kind of mimic each other.
They converge. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You want to.
They converge.
Yes.
The two accounts. Huh?
And so, for instance, like there's one thing that they both say, which, speaking of linguistics, it was like, so the dance floor of the Saint was this round, it was like a very, very big round room, like perfect circle. And there was no, it was like a casino. There's like no, clocks. There's no way to tell what time it is, basically. And it's designed that way. It's designed that way. So you stay and
right. You get lost in that world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Immerse yourself.
Right. And so, and that's like, if you like a lot of later discotheques or sort of like dance parties and things like that were sort of modeled after this place. And so the members had this sort of internal language of how to find each other in the space, because it was, there were no landmarks. There was no way to like situate exactly where you were. So there, but there was a DJ booth. So DJ booth was 12 o'clock.
Okay.
And so the language is like, I'm at 3 o'clock, I'm at 6 o'clock. And, I thought that was so beautiful that there was this secret language, that was formed just out of necessity for, and it's like, yeah, that was like a really, and I kind of ran with that for the work to have that be part of some of the pictures. So,
yeah. How wonderful that you can reimagine that and kind of keep that story alive, mm-hmm. and, you know, continuing to grow throughout history. You said that, yeah. That the, Light Your Name was a sort of an outgrowth of night music.
Yes.
Which is the series that you're working on right now, right?
So I like just finished it. It took me from, it was basically what I made from sort of the end of Ice Palace, so 2019, through the very, very start of, like, I took the last picture for it in January of this year. So, for me, that means, yes, that I'm still working on it, because it's like, just a lot of editing.
Still processing, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. A lot of, I'm in a stage now of sort of like sequencing and coming up with like a good edit of it, and sort of showing it to various, you know, people, publishers, applying to grants and things like that for it. So that's the stage I'm in. I would say that that work is, if you imagine the Ice Palace work in black and white and outside, that's, and then really a lot of the reason for that, a lot of the more logistical reason for that was COVID. So COVID was sort of like the wrench that thrown into my life, obviously everyone's life, that, that spurred that work.
Got you out of the studio setting and outside.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Or even just out of like being indoors with people, mm-hmm. being in private with, sharing air with people. Mm-hmm. That became sort of an idea in the work of like, the very like logistical thing of like, okay, let's try to just still make this picture in a safe way, but also sitting with this idea of like, okay, what's going to happen, like what's happening in the world, and what's, and thinking about also like a lot of the people I photograph, are usually making something creative of their own, or also artists or musicians or writers. And so it made me think a lot of, as I was making those outdoor pictures of them, this is like what I now am like using to like pitch the work and things like that, is like what I was thinking about as I was making those pictures was, what's going to happen to, like, what's going to happen in the world in the next, you know, month or whatever, you know, like with COVID, but then also making me think about this longer term thing of like, what happens to my work after I'm gone, and what happens to like, who takes care of it, and who, is it noticed? Is it recognized? Is it thinking about these like larger ideas about like legacy? Mm-hmm. At least that was what the anxiety in my life was at that time. Obviously,
About mortality a lot more during COVID.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And then, I mean, and I say that with the, you know, acknowledgement of like, I was able to even make my work still, which was such a blessing.
Yeah.
But in doing that, also thinking about, the place that I was working from as I made those portraits was like, wondering, okay, after I take this, what happens to it? And like in this sort of more meta way. Mm-hmm. So that was what was happening in my brain as I made those. yeah. And also just, like I said, you know, a lot of the people in the pictures maybe having those same questions for themselves. What would happen with their life and their work from there? So it's about legacy for me, that work. And I think the Light Your Name felt like a great kind of moment of that, because it was about the legacy of this place and sort of the interest in holding it up and making sure it's not forgotten for these two men.
That it remains in the light. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you were finishing up Night Music right as you were getting ready to apply to come here.
I was.
That was right around the deadline. That's right when we announced in January. That's when we announced that the applications were open. Yeah, so Aurora Photo Center, we have this project residency that's meant to emphasize and incorporate the people and place of Indianapolis, and that has to be essential to the project. And the whole jurying panel just loved your work, and especially its emphasis on Indianapolis and its people from your perspective. So it's been wonderful to have you here for the past two weeks.
It's been wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Yes. And I you've been so busy making portraits. We've barely had a chance to, we've had conversations here and there, a little bit of pieces. So it's wonderful to be able to sit down with you. But if you don't know about Ian's residency yet, he spent the past 2 weeks here making portraits of queer Hoosiers. And, you know, June is Pride Month. And so right in the middle of his 2 weeks was the Pride Festival. And Ian was there all day with his large format camera. How was that experience? Like, Yes, I was so glad to see that you found some shade someplace.
It was wonderful. I was like, so that's sort of like, feels like showtime for me. Like when I'm at an event where there's a lot of people that may be interested in a picture, a portrait. As I said, you know, with the Night Music work, it was a lot of like using the outdoor space as this, as a site, right? As like or using specifically like a public space as a site, and what people will sort of like do in a portrait, like in public versus private. And not to say, I mean, like a lot of it is just, I'm interested in how people negotiate their own body, like in a portrait regardless. But in public, there's this added kind of interesting wrench thrown into that. And
Watched, you mean? Especially when at a place where there are tons of other people around, like at the festival.
And I mean, not even just, you know, it doesn't even have to be such a public, like it can be, you know, in a public park or something. But like there was something I noticed with the with Indy Pride, where it was like you go to an event like that, you know, usually wearing something that is meant to be noticed or is meant to be sort of engaged with. And so that was, I didn't go in with quite as much anxiety as I normally do, because I was like, well, hopefully they're just, if nothing else, like flattered that I want to take the picture. And so that felt like this really generous space, right? Where, and I think there's something just with, I mean, not that it's not that I even have a rule necessarily that I only photograph like queer people, but that is just who I find myself among, who I photograph a lot. But there's just this like sense of like this like, it's like we speak the same language or something. Like there's this coded kind of thing of like, hopefully, you know, kind of like trust or being sure that it's a comfortable kind of safe space. And I felt so all week, I mean, not even just at Pride, but at the various other kind of auxiliary events, I felt so, my heart was very full, you know, being from here and feeling all week. I kept saying to people like, this is like the gayest like event I've been to in Indiana. And cause we really, I didn't have any exposure to that when I was growing up. So that was like, just really affirming. And it was affirming of this thing that I had sort of like said theoretically for so long, for years. And even when I was making the Mitch work, I was trying to make this thing about kind of like holding queer space in a place that potentially, and it's not that this isn't a generalization about Indiana, but you know, potentially in a place, let's say the United States of like actively trying to push something like that out. And I think so that's really, you know, at the heart of a lot of my work. So I it felt like this like almost celebratory thing to be, not almost, it was celebratory, like to be here making something that was kind of caught, like it wasn't just shrouded in this, or like kind of about like the isolation, or about the, it was more about like the kind of banding together of that, if it makes sense.
It does. And how wonderful that you could have that experience on your very first residency.
Yes, it was. That's right.
I hope this has been a good experience and that you continue to do more residencies. So you've been here for the past 2 weeks. This is your last day, and I'm afraid we're going to have to wrap up here because you have another portrait that you need to get to.
I do. I have like one or two, maybe two more. Yeah.
Before you leave town. I want to thank you again for this interview and for being here in our arts community for the past 2 weeks and being a wonderful start to our summer here. Thanks to WQRT, Big Car, and Tube Factory Art Space for their support again. And thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.